morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you for this wonderful film, which we're playing in our cinemas right now.
Oh, thank you.
Say, it's always a highlight to have a Pixar movie on the calendar.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
I think we probably last saw your name as director with Monsters University.
Yeah.
How's the last sort of 7 years been? What you've been, aside from Onward, what have you been up to?
really just that. I mean, you know, it really takes 7 years to make one of these movies. That said, at Pixar, we're always checking in on each other's films. So every film that's come out since then, we go to watch the screenings, the rough storyboard versions, and then we give our notes. And it's a great way to learn, too, because you see what other people are doing and think, oh, they're struggling with their lead character or they're losing some of the humor. And then you ask yourself, wait a minute, what are we doing? Maybe we're losing the humor. And you end up taking that back with you.
Sort of good just to peek out above your own project to see what else is going on.
Exactly. And there are times when directors don't go because they're too busy, obviously, near the end. And I think, just go. Find the time. It will benefit you, too.
Absolutely. So with Onward, coming off of Monsters University, going into Onward, what was the starting point for this?
Corey Ray, my filmmaking partner, and I had an opportunity to do an original film, or at least develop one, and we wanted to do something that came from an honest place, something maybe based on a personal story, which is usually where we start sometimes at Pixar. I had kind of talked to her about this thing in my life. My father passed away when I was a year old, and I don't remember him at all, naturally. And neither does my brother, who was three at the time. And we always wondered who he was and how we were like him. And that led to this idea, this sort of wish of what if you could spend a day with him and what would you learn? And that became the seed of Onward. And we knew that in order for that to be possible, we needed a world where that could happen, bring someone back for a day, and the idea of magic came up. And that's how we got into this sort of modern fantasy world.
Oh, wow, because the universe is so rich. Oh. It's this beautiful, sort of very realized, fantastic universe. That must be, I mean, it feels like, you know, you could spend all of that time just planning the world the film is set, let alone the story.
Yeah, I mean, you could, and luckily we have great artists at Pixar who really go deep. And my job is usually to stay focused on the story and what it needs, and give in some ways the bare minimum of what the world needs to be in order to tell that story. And then I trust them to really take it further than I could ever dream. There's still things in the movie, and I've seen it many, many times. There's still things in the background of the movie that I'm spotting. Characters and details. So yeah, it's a joy.
That must be quite fun.
Yeah.
What was the, when you start to sort of write the story and think of the idea, what was the first image you had in mind?
That's a really good question. A long time ago, Corey and I went to Dartmouth College, and they showed sort of a retrospective of Pixar, and they showed images from the films and mainly just played the music from the films. And I realized watching the movies without sound that every one of those movies had some image that on its own was really strong, you know, a fish, you know, the Nemo one was like the little egg of Nemo with it sliced down the middle and seeing that injured fish, a monster hugging a child. You didn't need to see the movies. They were strong images. And, I don't think I started with an image, but without spoiling the end, there is imagery at the end that I think on its own is pretty strong. And anyway, it was one of those lessons where you're out doing press and you wouldn't even think about it, and then suddenly you have this idea dawns on you of there should be a strong image that kind of tells the story.
No, absolutely. And I think you're right. You know, Pixar does have those, a single character, a silhouette of a character even sort of says so much.
Yeah.
I loved the central relationship. I have a brother myself.
Are you older or younger?
I'm the older brother. Okay. And I mean, I don't think I'm like Barley to my brother's Ian, but maybe I am to him. I don't know. Need to have a conversation. But it was really nice to see brotherhood on screen like that. It felt like a very honest relationship.
Yeah, my brother and I get along really well, almost too well, to the point where it wouldn't be realistic in a movie. There'd be no drama at all. And so obviously, even though Ian and Barley are based on my brother and I in the larger sense, the characterizations of Barley are very different than my brother for those dramatic reasons. But it was important to me that we not go to the well of these two brothers hate each other, and the older brother's always telling the younger brother to scram and get lost and don't be such a nerd. And try to get a little closer to what my brother and I think others have, siblings, which is that even though Ian and Barley are super different, they do clearly love each other from the beginning of the movie. If anything, they're not fighting enough. They kind of need to talk about things, which I think is can be equally dangerous, especially sometimes with men, especially myself from the Midwest of America, who don't talk about our feelings. And don't express them. And I think that there's a real sensitivity between these two that I think is unique.
I think what sort of struck real for me is I don't really spend enough time with my brother. We live in different towns. But when we're together, it's like we've never been apart.
Yeah.
And I think in the film, you have that too. They don't like spending time together at the beginning. But when they're forced together, they get on so well.
Yeah, I think there's a sense that even though they are different and they kind of get on each other's nerves, that yes, when forced together, when together, they do have touchstones, and they do have a certain language. Yeah,
when working on a story like this at Pixar, and it's about a real life family dynamic, do lots of the teams sort of chip in with, well, me and my family are like this?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned it, because even though this started as my personal story, it's not an autobiography. As a matter of fact, I mean, from the beginning, Corey Ray, the producer in the film, she said, oh, wow, this is like my sister and I. And then as artists came on, they would tell us their story about their family. And we would, we'd hear these beautiful, wonderful, emotional stories, and we'd think, ooh, we're using that. it's kind of messed up. But I think all the artists there are like, that's what we're there for. We're there to share our experience so that hopefully when audiences go see this movie, they say, hey, that is my story too, and they see a little of themselves in it.
It's also, it's a fantastic, beautifully animated film, but it's got reality in there.
Yeah, I think you want to have heart and a, some connection in a comedy that is also this wild adventure.
Are you a fantasy sort of nerd yourself?
I'm not. I'm different kinds of nerd, but I wasn't a fantasy nerd, and neither was Corey. We didn't know a lot about it, and I think that's sort of a fun thing that happens when you make a movie, when you find yourself saying, like, this movie would be best if it took place in a fantasy world, if it was a fantasy, and then you think, am I going to make a fantasy movie? The same was true with Monsters University. There's a very major competition element to that movie, and I thought, am I making a sports movie? And I think the cool thing is you get the right people around you to help you make that correctly and help you make that in a way that's respectful, especially with fantasy fans. We didn't want to just make fun of fantasy. We wanted to have fun. But then I think because I'm new to it, hopefully you might not fall into all the same tropes. You might do things that are unique, even if you're doing it by accident.
I mean, little things like, you have a magic card game in there, which I think a lot of fantasy fans would identify playing something similar, and that sort of rings true, and it feels like that is speaking to that fantasy fan base.
So many of the artists on the movie who helped write it and develop it are super into role-playing games. They really helped us know how to do it right, and so we did learn a lot as we went.
Did you ever dip your toe? Did you sign up to a role-playing game?
We played once or twice. And what I was blown away by is how, it's the person running the game has to be like on their toes with storytelling. It's just storytelling and improv. And it's incredibly creative. I think we were both surprised by that and didn't realize that.
Absolutely. I think it's, that person's got a lot of power, but you do have to be a storyteller at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there a scene which you sort of had at the very beginning of this process which has made its way all the way into the final movie?
The end. Yeah, the end of the movie. Sort of that image I mentioned earlier. Even though I didn't have that image right away, but I knew what I wanted to say. The end really inspired making the movie at all. And I think that's really helpful when you're writing something. If you have that North Star that you're headed toward, don't get me wrong, everything on the way there changed a million times for 6 years, and we there were moments we were completely lost, but we always knew where we were headed.
It must be actually quite good having an anchor point. You know, we have to get to this, and everything before it needs to make sense.
Yeah, I think you want to have a reason to have made a movie and something you want to say. It doesn't mean that every movie has to start out knowing that. I'm glad, I feel lucky that this particular one did. The problem is you have to earn it, and so it's still really hard, and you spend years trying to earn the ending.
You've got, obviously, we talked about the central characters, the two brothers, but you've got this amazing supporting cast. What did they? How did they come into the picture?
Well, you know, my brother and I were raised by my mom, and my mom was an important part of our lives. Naturally, I mean, she was our support and our inspiration and our protector. And so Laurel Lightfoot plays the boy's mother in this movie, and I think it's, you know, it's really the three of them against the world, and it's the three of them trying to get, you know, to get make this reunion happen. And my mom is very funny and sort of has a gallows humor, and so Julia Louis-Dreyfus is perfect for that because she's just so strong and hilarious, and you know, you can see how she could have raised those boys, dealing with Barley, who's a little wild, and Ian, who's a little sensitive, takes a softer touch. And then Octavia Spencer plays the Manticore, and we, you know, all these great fantasy movies have that tavern that you have to go to, and then they have great warriors, and we wanted one character who had experienced the world the way it was. And it's never said in the movie, but the Manticore is 1,000 years old and, you know, used to be a big part of the world. And Octavia Spencer just brings this hilarious drama to the role. She can play really big. And, you know, quests oftentimes have a side quest too. So it was really nice to have Octavia and Julia on this amazing side quest to help save the boys.
It was quite, because I really liked the beginning of the film when you see the family unit, the three of them. And when the boys went off, I was a bit worried we wouldn't see the mother again. But yeah. I loved that she had her own mission.
Yeah.
And that she's so go-getting, like, got to save my boys.
And the other thing that was important is she's not just trying to save them, she's trying to help them. Even though she knows it's dangerous, she knows it's important, and she trusts their ability. And to be honest, we did versions of the movie where she was just trying to stop them out of safety. And you really didn't root for her, and she felt like she wasn't really a part of the family unit, and it didn't feel true and honest that these three are a team and they would do anything for each other. And
also, like, you get some proper sort of road trip movie sort of humor between the mother and the Manticore.
Yeah. Well, the idea of, like, once we said that we wanted the Manticore to go along with mom, we're like, how are we fitting her in the car? And it was cool because I said, make sure you design the car big enough for the Manticore. And the animators kept saying, like, don't worry about it. She's so, like, muscular and larger than life, we want to just squeeze her in there. They did.
You also have that really nice flourish of whenever the Manticore's in the car, the sort of, it's just rubbing against the highway.
Yeah, just that sense that she's this grand creature and she's stuffed into this tiny little car. It feels like the movie in a whole. We wanted to make sure we always had majestic, amazing grandeur next to everyday mundanity.
A pair of legs is a very significant part of the film, and the sort of dummy-like torso that's floating on top. I just really loved how well designed that was, and it's a classic sort of silent character who's very emotive with their movements. Was it hard to get that right?
It is hard. It's because you don't want to stop down the movie for him to fall down and do a bunch of silly stuff. But you want him to have moments. He is a character, and you want him to be a part of the movie. And his attitude is always one of just love for the boys. He probably, we told the animators that he probably realizes, oh, this went wrong, but that's okay. They're here. And the thing he cares most about is that they're together. They must have grown up to love each other. So you see him throughout the movie tapping their feet, always making sure they're together, always making sure they love each other. And he'd be happy if that's all he got. And so that's the way we treated him. And then we made sure his movements, we thought he should be doing big, broad actions to act with his feet. And then we realized, no, you can do pretty small stuff.
It was really, I thought that was really touching. And actually just simple things like a foot tap means so much in this film.
Especially when you're reading into it. You know, I think we as human beings, yeah, I mean, we anthropomorphize everything, you know, and we read into stuff. So you're really watching his feet to try to figure out what he's thinking. And then the silly upper half is sort of not really a part of him, but every now and then we cheat it to almost feel like it is. But Yeah, it was a fun thing to figure out.
Just like designing the physics and movement of it is, it sort of feels right.
Yeah.
If I was ever in that, you know, that's sort of how you think that would move.
We actually, when we were designing the top half, we were kind of drawing it a lot and sculpting it in the computer. And then at some point we just said, why don't we just make the upper half? I mean, it's just make it out of clothes and stuffed coats and things. And we did. They made like a little puppet, and I gave notes on that, and I'd want this cinched up here and more stuffing there, and then they made it in the computer.
That must be, if you came into that meeting room when they're stuffing the jumper.
What are they making? This is the stupidest thing in the world. Yeah.
Don't worry, guys, it's part of the new film. There is a really great moment of farce, and actually that design, character design leads to a lot of really fun sort of moments, but in the gas station in particular, with the what happens in there, it's quite fun having sort of this innocuous character not realizing the chaos they're causing
right
around them.
That moment in the gas station is really an opportunity where Ian, the little brother, due to circumstances of his older brother being shrunk and all that, he has to be the adult for a moment, and he has to take care of his now little big brother, and he has to take care of his dad, who is almost like a dog on a leash. And we really wanted him to feel like the overburdened parent in that moment, just so he'd get a taste of what it's like.
That's a good good way to confront your fears.
Yeah.
You've got you mentioned you got this amazing cast. How did you find your leads, Tom Holland and Chris Pratt?
I mean, it feels weird now because they seem so obvious. But, you know, we take a lot of time. We're developing the characters on the page. And before we go out to actors and developing the look of the characters before we go out to actors. And Ian needed to be very sort of shy and awkward and someone who lacked confidence, but you want to be able to enjoy watching that. And Tom does that kind of nervous, shy, awkward kid in a really funny way. But he's also very sincere and charismatic, charming person. And so we went to Tom first and pitched him the movie, actually flew to London and pitched him here. We recorded Tom in London once, so London has been a part of this movie for us for a while. And then we went to Chris after, because Barley has to be big and wild and chaotic and even annoying at times, but you don't want it to annoy the audience, and Chris can get away with anything and make it charming. To be honest, in the moment when we thought of Chris, it didn't dawn on us right away that they had been in the Marvel movies together. But it was a happy accident in that they're friends, and that brotherly relationship is kind of real.
Absolutely. You really buy it together, even though, you know, actually there's a sort of an age gap there, and they're from, they've grown up in different places, but they're so good on screen.
Yeah, yeah.
I also wanted to ask, just finally, you've got the same music team who worked on The Good Dinosaur. Fantastic score for that, and a fantastic score for this. How did you approach the sound for this film, the score?
Well, I mean, when I heard their music, I thought these guys are perfect, Jeff Dana and Michael Dana, because their music in everything they've done has great emotion that comes through, and emotion is a big part of this movie. And then they can do big, epic, sprawling adventure anthems, which they do a lot in Good Dino as well. And that's how I thought they'd be perfect for it. And then we just talked about... you know, being a starting small like Ian does, and then being able to build to something that is huge, that is a proper fantasy anthem. And I think that was kind of the gist of the kicking off point of what we talked about with them.
How did you feel when you first heard that music to your picture?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, they do these amazing demos that sound practically like they've already been recorded with an orchestra. But the first time I heard Ian's theme song, it just so perfectly wrapped up. You could tell that it was a very sweet, small, sensitive person's song, but you could hear in it, oh, but they're going to be able to blow the doors off of it in the end when he's really comes into himself. So it was just amazing. I mean, we spend so much time on this, and then they come in and in the last year create one of the most secondary creative parts, you know what I mean, of the film. And they basically, you know, they do so much work on this film that affects it in such a major way. It was a joy.
Well, fab. Well, thank you very much, Dan. Looking forward to playing the film in our cinemas.
Absolutely.
Onwards out now. Thank you.
Thank you.